every single hockey coach, from like Pee Wee leagues all the way to the NHL, they will all tell you the exact same thing. They'll say, the center covers the most ice and skates the furthest.
Oh, yeah, you hear all the time.
Right. It's just repeated in locker rooms everywhere. It's like this absolute truth of the game. But it's actually completely mathematically wrong.
It really is. It's a perfect example of how a coaching assumption just sort of morphs into an unquestioned law just through sheer repetition.
Yeah, exactly. So today we're taking you, the listener, right into the middle of the most demanding, the most misunderstood, and honestly, arguably the most strategically complex forward position in ice hockey.
Right, the center.
Exactly. We are taking a deep dive into the center position today. And our mission here isn't just to, give you a basic summary of where to stand when the puck drops.
No, definitely not. We want to build an integrated, highly advanced mental model of the position.
Right. Because we really want to elevate your understanding of the game so that you can recognize the underlying patterns, apply those complex systems, and honestly manipulate the rule book like a veteran pro.
Yeah, that's the ultimate goal. Because to truly master this position, or I mean, even just to watch a game and understand what's actually happening away from the puck, you have to stop reacting and start processing.
You need to see the architecture of the game.
Precisely. You need to see the architecture.
And to see that architecture, we really have to clear away the myths first. So let's start with that cliche about the center skating the furthest, because you brought in some hard data that just completely shatters this idea.
I did, yeah. Because if we want to build a real mental model, we have to start with facts, right? Not locker room folklore.
Right, exactly. So what does the data actually say?
Okay, so in 2018, there was this researcher named Lignell, and Lignell and a team of colleagues did a study where they tracked 36 NHL players.
Oh, wow. Like with actual tracking technology.
Exactly. They used player tracking tech to measure the actual positional workload during live games. And the data showed that defensemen actually skate 29% more total distance than forwards over the course of a game.
Wait, 29% more? That's a massive difference.
It's huge. And furthermore, defensemen are on the ice 47% longer. I mean, a typical NHL defenseman averages around 24 shifts a game.
Okay, and what about a forward?
A forward averages about 19.4 shifts. So if we are strictly talking about raw mileage, the defensemen just win by a landslide.
I mean, that makes intuitive sense when you think about the actual ice time, right?
Yeah.
But forwards are clearly exerting a massive amount of energy. So where do the forwards, and specifically the centers, actually take the lead in that data?
That's the key. Forwards win decisively on high-intensity skating. The study found that forwards perform 54% more high-intensity skating per minute than defensemen do.
54% more. So it's a totally different type of skating.
Exactly. It's a sprint-heavy workload. Like a defenseman is doing a lot of gliding, pivoting, and backward skating, managing the gap.
Right.
But a center is constantly accelerating, stopping, and initiating these high-speed foot races. But the raw marathon mileage, that belongs to the blue line.
Okay, let's unpack this. So if the center isn't logging the most miles, we need to redefine what their spatial job actually is, right?
We do. And the paradigm shift that you, as the listener, really need to internalize right now is this: the center doesn't cover the most mileage, they cover the most territory.
Okay, territory. Let's define the difference between those two concepts, just to be super clear.
Yeah, so mileage is just a measure of distance traveled, right? But territory is about geographic responsibility.
Ah, okay, geographic responsibility.
Exactly. The center's job spans all three zones of the rink: the defensive zone, the neutral zone, and the offensive zone. And it spans the full width of the ice, from boards to boards.
So you're basically the link between all five skaters on your team.
Exactly right. I mean, a winger largely stays on their half of the ice, a defenseman largely stays in the back half of the play. But your job as a center moves dynamically with the puck.
Territory over mileage. I love
Yeah.
that. That's a foundational shift in how to view the ice. And it leads us to another really fundamental concept we need to establish before we start dissecting specific plays.
Which is understanding the system mindset.
Right. The system mindset. Explain what that means.
Well, this is where a lot of players and fans get really confused. Almost everything a center is told to do, where to stand on a defensive draw, when to pressure a puck carrier, who to pick up on the rush, all of that is actually a coaching choice.
It's a system.
Exactly. It's a system. It is not an immutable law of hockey.
So it's kind of like the difference between physics and traffic laws.
Well, that's a great way to put it. Yeah.
Because, like, The puck sliding on the ice is physics.
Yeah.
It acts the exact same way everywhere, but your coach telling you to trap the winger against the boards, that is a traffic law.
Exactly. It's a rule designed by a human to manage the flow. And a different coach might have a completely different traffic law for that exact same intersection.
Right, which means if you don't understand the difference, you're in trouble.
You lose all adaptability. Because when a system breaks down, and in hockey, I mean, the systems break down every few seconds, you will just freeze because you only memorize the traffic law.
So understanding the underlying why is really the secret to high IQ adaptable play.
That's it, exactly.
So to build this mental model for you guys listening, we're going to move logically through the game.
Mm-hmm.
We'll establish the basic spatial language of the ice first, then we'll drop into the defensive zone, figure out how to break out, transition through the neutral zone, and attack the offensive zone.
And along the way, we're going to decode the hidden math of face-offs, too.
Oh, yeah. And we'll navigate the incredibly dangerous, completely legal traps hidden in the rule books regarding the goal crease and back-checking.
Let's begin by defining that spatial language, then. Because if we are going to break down complex systems, we need a really firm, unwavering mental map of the ice.
Right. So let's establish the core vocabulary, starting with high versus low. And strong versus weak. Because these terms get thrown around constantly on broadcasts, but they shift depending on who has the puck and where we are, right?
I do. So let's anchor them right now.
Yeah.
High always refers to the direction of the blue line you are currently facing.
Okay, so toward the point.
Yes. And low always refers to the goal line behind you. And this orientation remains true regardless of which the three zones you are standing in.
Got it. So if you are moving higher, you're moving toward the blue line. And lower is deep into the zone toward the end boards.
Exactly.
Okay, and what about strong side versus weak side?
So imagine the ice is split longitudinally right down the middle. Strong side is simply the half of the ice where the puck currently is. Weak side is the half of the ice without the pick.
Okay, seems simple enough.
It is, but here is the critical insight for the center. A winger's defensive assignment is relatively static. The left winger mostly stays on the left, but as a center, your defensive responsibilities switch sides every single time the puck crosses the center line of the rink.
Oh, wow. So you are completely tethered to the puck.
You are.
Which means your processing speed has to be faster than anyone else's.
Yeah.
I mean, every time a pass goes across the ice, your entire defensive assignment flips in a fraction of a second.
Exactly. You have to be hyper aware.
Okay, let's add another term to this map. The half wall.
Yes, the half wall. That's the area along the sideboards, roughly positioned between the face-off dot and the top of the face-off circle.
And when we talk about the center's spatial rules, there's one that is nearly universal about this spot, right?
Very universal. The half wall is strictly winger's ice.
But why is it so rigid? Like, what happens if I, as the center, decide to just go engage on the half wall to help my winger out?
You collapse your team's spacing, and honestly, you do the opponent's job for them.
Really? How so?
Well, if you drift out onto the half wall next to your winger, one single opposing defender can now guard both of you simultaneously.
Oh, because you're standing right next to each other.
Exactly. But more importantly, you have just abandoned the middle of the ice. And the center of the rink is the most dangerous, highest leverage real estate.
So if you vacate it to go stand on the half wall, you just destroy the structural integrity of your whole line.
You do. You essentially take yourself out of the play by standing in an area that is already occupied.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. Now let's redefine another term that I think is almost universally misunderstood, even by people who have played the game for years. The forecheck designations.
Hmm?
You know, F1, F2, and F3.
Oh, this is a big one.
Yeah, because I have always operated under the assumption that F1 was just the center's permanent job, F2 was the strong side winger, and F3 was the weak side winger. Is that wrong?
That is a completely static way of thinking, and it will get you beat on the ice every time.
Seriously?
Yeah. F1, F2, and F3 are not positions on a roster. They are temporary roles, and they are defined strictly by the order of arrival to the puck.
Okay, let's use an analogy here to make sure this really clicks for the listener. Think of a play on the ice like an emergency medical response.
Okay, I like this.
So, if there's an accident, it does not matter if the first person to arrive is a highly trained surgeon, let's call him the center, or a registered nurse, the winger. The absolute first person on the scene has to initiate the triage, right?
Right. They have to apply the pressure immediately.
Exactly. They become F1. So if my winger is skating faster than me and reaches the corner first, that winger is instantly F1. I cannot just skate up behind them and say, you know, hold on, I'm the center, I'll take it from here.
That is the exact mechanism. If your winger beats you to the puck, they are F1. You as the center must instantly read that reality, adapt, and become F2.
Which is the immediate support role.
Yes. And F3 is the third player arriving, who stays high as a safety valve. If you are rigid and insist on playing F1 just because you are the center, you'll hesitate, you'll arrive late, and the opponent will break out cleanly.
So the mental model here is super fluid. You process who is closest, assign them F1 in your head, and fall into the corresponding support role.
Precisely. Positional flexibility, driven by reading the play, completely overrides static positioning.
Right. So to recap for the listener, maintain your spacing, stay off the half wall, track the puck to understand your strong or weak side responsibilities, and realize that your role as F1, F2, or F3 changes second by second based purely on proximity and speed.
That is the perfect summary.
Awesome. So with that vocabulary established, we can now step into the most critical area of the ice for a center, the defensive zone. Because when we are in our own end, the center is the anchor.
You are. You are the structural link that disrupts the opponent's offense.
Right, particularly when they're trying to sustain a cycle. And for anyone who doesn't know, a cycle is when they use the corners and boards to continually pass the puck in a loop, just wearing the defense down.
Exactly. And to understand how to break that cycle, we need to look at the default defensive system used by the vast majority of teams.
Which is called the low zone collapse.
Yes, the low zone collapse.
So walk us through the mechanics of this. Like, what do we do when we do not have the puck?
Okay, so in this system, when the opposing team has the puck down low in your strong side corner, your job as the center is to go deep into that corner to support your strong side defenseman.
Okay, so I go all the way into the corner. Why?
The goal is to create a two-on-one physical battle for the puck against that opposing forward. The underlying logic is simple. Two bodies on the puck usually wins the battle and breaks the cycle.
But wait, if I am leaving the middle of the ice, specifically the high slot, that area between the face-off circles right in front of the net, and I am going all the way down into the corner, who is covering the slot?
Ah, that's the big question.
Because that is the most dangerous real estate on the ice. Leaving that open seems like a fatal flaw in the system.
It is a fatal flaw, but only if you fail to execute the rotation.
Okay, the rotation. Explain that.
This is the hidden machinery of the low zone collapse. When you, the center, leave the high slot to dig in the corner, your weak side winger must immediately collapse down to cover the high slot you just vacated.
Okay, and just to clarify, the weak side winger is normally covering the point, right? Like the area near the blue line guarded by the opposing defenseman.
Exactly. But they have to drop down, so it's a synchronized exchange of territory. You go low, the weak side winger drops down into the middle.
But how do they know I'm leaving?
That's the linchpin. Early communication. You are handing off the responsibility for the most dangerous patch of ice. If you leave the slot silently, your winger won't know to draw.
And then the slot just remains empty.
Yes. And an opposing forward will walk right into that space for a high danger shot. You have to communicate before you leave.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, are there any scenarios where I shouldn't go into the corner? Like, exceptions to this rule?
There are two main exceptions. First, if you look down and see that your strong side winger is already engaged in the corner alongside your defenseman, you stay out.
Because the two-on-one is already established.
Right. You just hold the high slot.
And what's the second exception?
The second is if the opposing weak side defenseman decides to pinch, meaning they abandon the blue line and skate deep into the zone to join the attack.
Right. Because if they pinch, my weak side winger is forced to follow them, right?
Exactly. Because if the winger doesn't follow, that pinching defenseman is wide open backdoor. But if your weak side winger is occupied tracking a pinch, they cannot collapse into the slot to cover for you.
Oh, man. So in that moment, I have to run a rapid risk assessment. Like, does the corner need my help more, or is the high slot an immediate danger?
Exactly. You have to read the threats and make a judgment call on the fly.
That is a lot of processing. Okay, let's progress the scenario. Say we execute the two-on-one in the corner and we actually win the puck. We're transitioning from defending to breaking out. What is my spatial responsibility as the center now that my defenseman has the puck behind our net?
Now, you must execute a concept known as swinging low.
Swinging low, okay.
Yeah, as your defense prepares to pass, you need to skate below the hash marks. Those are the short lines intersecting the face-off circles, and you need to position yourself inside the face-off dots, moving in the direction of the breakout.
But why do I need to be so deep? I mean, if we just won the puck, shouldn't I be stretching the ice, skating higher up toward the blue line to create a fast break?
So that is a system called the center fly. And to be fair, some teams do use it. But in a standard structure, if you fly high and your wingers are also positioned high on the boards waiting for a pass, you have completely isolated your defenseman.
Oh, but they're all the way back there alone.
Exactly. The defenseman has the puck. They are likely under pressure from four checkers. And they have absolutely no short, safe, predictable outlet pass. By swinging low, you provide an immediate release valve.
So if you abandon that space, your defense is just stranded.
Completely stranded.
Okay, so let's explore what happens when I receive that breakout pass. I swing low, my defenseman hits me on the tape, but I am instantly under heavy pressure. Like two opposing forecheckers are converging on me right in the middle of our defensive zone.
Like a very common scenario.
Right. Now, I want to challenge a common coaching narrative here. If I have the puck in the middle and a defender is rushing me, isn't that the perfect time to make a skill play?
Absolutely not.
Wait, hear me out. Say I use a toe drag where I pull the puck backward toward my skates to slip it past their stick and I beat that first guy. I would instantly open up the entire ice for an odd man rush. Why wouldn't I take that chance?
Because the math of risk management strictly prohibits it. You never, under any circumstances, try to carry the puck through heavy pressure in the middle of your own defensive zone.
Never.
Yeah.
Like, even if I have the skill to pull it off 8 times out of 10?
Never. Because the 2 times you fail will literally cost your team the game. It is a coaching consensus across all levels, and it is based on the catastrophic cost of a turnover in that specific location.
Okay, explain the mechanics of why that specific turnover is so deadly compared to, say, losing the puck on the boards.
It all comes down to shot danger and recovery time. If you lose a puck battle along the boards, the opponent still has to pass it to the middle to get a good shot, right?
Right, which takes time.
Exactly. It takes time. It gives your goalie a second to adjust their angle, and it gives your defense a second to collapse and block the lane. But if you try a toe drag in the low slot and lose the puck, the opposing forward already has it in the most dangerous shooting location on the ice.
Oh, wow. Yeah, they don't have to pass. They just shoot.
Exactly. You have afforded your goalie 0 seconds of recovery time. It is a high percentage, instant strike scoring chance.
That is terrifying. So if a skill play is completely off the table and I am trapped in the middle, what are the actual mechanical solutions to survive that pressure?
You have 2 primary options. You rim or you reverse.
Okay. What does it mean to rim it?
If the forechecking pressure is sealing you in from the front, taking away your forward lanes, you rim the puck. You shoot it hard around the boards, continuing in the direction you are facing, to bypass the pressure and let your winger battle for it further up the ice.
Okay, and what if the pressure is coming at me laterally with too much speed, like from the side?
If the forechecker has overcommitted and is flying at you from the side, you reverse it. You send the puck back against the flow of the play, usually banking it off the boards behind your own net, into an area where your defense partner is arriving to support.
So the core principle here is that advancing the puck safely out of the middle is always prioritized over attempting a highlight reel play in a high-risk zone.
Always. Every single time.
So to quickly synthesize the defensive zone for the listener, when we don't have the puck, we collapse low to create a 2-on-1, but we loudly communicate the rotation so the high slot is covered.
Right.
And when we win the puck, we swing below the hash marks to give the defense an outlet. And if we receive that puck under pressure in the middle, we never try to stick handle our way out. We rim it or reverse it to live another day.
Precisely. That discipline is exactly what separates a reliable center from a defensive liability.
Okay, so let's say we successfully execute that breakout. We transition out of our defensive zone and cross the first blue line. That brings us right into the neutral zone.
The transition space.
Right, the middle third of the ice. And the center is effectively the point guard here. Let's start with carrying the puck in free space.
If you receive the puck with speed and have open ice in the neutral zone, you want to carry it straight up the middle lane.
Why the middle? Like, why not drive down the boards to protect the puck using your body?
It is pure geometry. When you operate in the center lane, your field of vision is perfectly optimized. You have a direct sight line to your left winger, your right winger, and both trailing defensemen. You have 360 degrees of distribution options. If you drive down the boards, you eliminate half your options immediately.
That makes total sense.
Huh.
So your job in the middle lane is to evaluate the speed of your wingers. And if one of them has a better angle to enter the offensive zone in full stride, you distribute the puck to them.
Exactly.
Okay, but what if I don't have free space? Say I cross the blue line and immediately face a wall of defending players just standing their ground.
In that situation, you chip the puck off the boards deep into their zone or you pass it wide to a winger. You do not force a play through the middle.
Is this the exact same risk management principle we talked about in the defensive zone?
It is very similar, yes, but the consequence is different. A turnover in the middle of your defensive zone leads to an instant shot. A turnover in the middle of the neutral zone gives birth to an odd man rush.
Okay, let's define an odd man rush for clarity.
Sure. An odd man rush is a counterattack where the offensive team has more players pressing forward than the defending team has back to stop them, like a 3-on-2 or a 2-on-1.
Oh, right. Because when you carry the puck up the middle of the neutral zone, your teammates are generally moving forward with you.
Exactly. So if you get stripped of the puck in the center lane, your teammates are caught moving the wrong direction, and the opponent instantly transitions the other way with a numerical advantage.
Wow. Yeah. So chipping the puck wide ensures that even if you lose possession, it happens on the perimeter, which slows down the counterattack and gives your team time to retreat.
That's the exact reason we do it.
That makes total sense. Now, let's flip the scenario. The opponent has the puck, and they are trying to transition through the neutral zone against us.
Yeah.
What is my role without the puck?
Well, as the center, you are very frequently F1 in the neutral zone. Your primary objective is to steer the puck carrier to the outside, pinning them against the boards where your wingers and defensemen are waiting to trap them.
But how aggressive should I be? Like, am I trying to physically hit them and steal a puck? Or just get in their way?
That entirely depends on the specific system your coach has deployed. This is a massive variable.
Okay, break that down for us.
If your team runs a 1-2-2 containment system, your goal is passive structure. You are simply taking away the middle lane and forcing them wide. You want them to get frustrated and make a poor pass. You are not aggressively hunting the puck.
And what's the alternative?
The alternative is an aggressive neutral zone press where two forwards hunt the puck carrier simultaneously to force a turnover right at center ice.
So you really must know which system you are running.
You have to. If you try to aggressively press when your team is set up in a 1-2-2 containment, you will fly past the puck carrier, take yourself completely out of the play, and give the opponent a free lane right into your defensive zone.
Right. It all comes back to knowing the traffic laws your coach has set up. Okay, so now let's talk about the mechanics of entering the offensive zone. Specifically, supporting the rush and managing the offside line. Because this is something I see go wrong constantly at the amateur level.
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge issue.
Right. Like, a winger is flying up the boards with the puck, the center is driving hard up the middle, and right before the blue line, the center just slams on the brakes and starts coasting to make sure they don't drift offside.
It is incredibly common, and it completely destroys the momentum of the rush. When you coast at the blue line, you enter the offensive zone with zero velocity.
And what's the consequence of that?
A forward line that enters the zone slowly will instantly get stood up, separated from the puck, and crushed by the opposing defensemen who are matching their speed backward.
So how do you fix it? How do you stay onside without killing your speed?
You have to master your spatial timing. You read the speed of the puck carrier and adjust your strides further back in the neutral zone so that you arrive at the blue line at maximum velocity, perfectly level with or slightly behind the puck.
So you manage your timing before you arrive. You never sacrifice line speed.
Never.
But staying onside can be tricky because the exact definition of what constitutes an offside actually changes depending on what rule book your game is governed by.
Yes, this is where it gets really complicated.
Let's look closely at this because this nuance is wild to me. Does your trailing skate physically have to be touching the ice to keep you onside?
It completely depends on the league you're in. If you are playing under NHL or IIHF rules, which govern professional hockey and international play, including domestic leagues in Britain, the rule states that a trailing skate hovering in the air over the blue line keeps you onside.
Wait, really? Just in the air?
Yes. The plane of the blue line extends vertically in a 3D space. As long as your skate hasn't crossed that invisible wall, you are onside, whether the blade is on the ice or in the air.
So a player can drag their toe in the air behind them while stretching for a pass. That's crazy. But what about in North America at the amateur level?
If you are playing under USA Hockey or Hockey Canada rules, that exact same airborne skate is completely offside.
Really?
Yeah. Their rule books require physical continuous skate contact with the ice until the puck crosses the line. If you lift that back blade even half an inch off the ice before the puck crosses, the linesman will blow the whistle.
That is a massive operational difference.
Yeah.
You could easily have a kid who grows up watching Connor McDavid drag his foot in the air on TV, goes to a USA Hockey tournament, tries the exact same move, and gets whistled down every single time.
Exactly. And honestly, the rule book differences get even more complex when we look at delayed offsides and tag up rules.
Right. Let's break down the tag up. This is the scenario where the puck is shot into the offensive zone, but a player on the attacking team is already inside the zone, making the play offside, right?
Right.
But the whistle doesn't blow immediately because it's a delayed offside, so how does a team legally reset the play?
It requires a 5-man tag up. The delayed offside is only nullified when every single player on the offending team clears the zone by making skate contact with the blue line.
And they must all be clear at the exact same instant.
Yes. And as the center, because you are usually navigating the middle of the ice, you often have to act as the quarterback here. You have to visually count your wingers out of the zone before you can turn back in to chase the puck.
But there's a massive trap here for youth players in the United States, isn't there?
A very severe trap, yeah. USA Hockey only permits delayed offsides and the tag-up rule for specific age brackets, youth 15 and over, high school, and adult classifications.
Oh, wow. So what happens if you're younger?
If you are playing in a 14U game or younger, there is no delayed offside. The moment the puck crosses the line while a player is offside, it is an immediate dead play whistle. There is no opportunity to tag up.
That is wild. So as a center navigating the neutral zone, you have to read the geometry of the middle lane, know exactly how your coach wants you to pressure, time your entry speed perfectly, and have a literal legal understanding of the offside rules specific to your country and age group.
It's a lot to process, for sure.
It really is. All right, that brings us across the blue line. We are into the offensive zone, and we need to talk about generating offense and surviving the most heavily policed area of the ice, which is the goal crease. Let's start with puck possession. We have the puck in the offensive zone. Where should I be shooting from?
Let's rely on the hard math of the slot here. The slot is the rectangular area stretching between the two face-off circles directly in front of the net.
Right.
Data tracking shows that a shot taken from the slot converts into a goal roughly 10% to 15% of the time. But a shot taken from the perimeter along the boards or near the blue line converts at only 2% to 4%.
That is a staggering discrepancy. A shot from the slot is worth roughly 3 to 7 times more than a perimeter shot.
Exactly. The math demands that you prioritize this space. If you are carrying the puck into the slot and you have a clear lane, you shoot.
Because a lot of centers try to overprocess the game here, don't they?
They do. They look for a cute highlight reel pass to the back door. Do not overthink it. If you have the puck in the high percentage real estate, put it on the net.
Okay, but what if I carry the puck deep, all the way behind the opponent's net?
Mm-hmm.
What is the mathematical play from back there?
Well, the area behind the net is a tactical sanctuary. You are shielded from hits, you can pivot, and you have a clear view of all 9 other skaters in the zone.
And what do the statistics tell us to do from that sanctuary?
Passing the puck from below the goal line out to a teammate stationed in the slot forces the goaltender to react to the pass, rotate their body, and slide laterally. They have to cross an imaginary line splitting the ice in half, which analytics experts call the Royal Road.
Right, because crossing that line forces the goalie to physically reset their depth and angle, which takes a fraction of a second they just don't have.
Exactly. And the data proves how lethal it is. A pass from below the goal line into the slot is the second most dangerous pass in all of hockey, converting into a goal at nearly 6.7%.
That's huge. So when you are pivoting behind the net, your primary objective is scanning the slot for a teammate arriving late.
Yes.
Okay, that is offense with the puck. What happens if the opponent retrieves the puck deep in their zone and we have to forecheck them?
Remember our F1 rule from earlier? Whoever is closest drives straight at the puck carrier. But the tactical instruction here is to steer, not necessarily to deliver a massive hit.
Then why not hit them? If I can separate the defenseman from the puck with a big shoulder check, shouldn't I take that opportunity?
Because a missed hit takes you completely out of the play. If you focus entirely on the physical collision, a smart defenseman will just absorb it and move the puck, or simply dodge you.
So what's the alternative?
Your primary job as F1 is to take a deliberate skating angle that steers the defenseman toward one specific side of the boards. You want to make their movement predictable so that your F2 winger knows exactly where to go to cut them off and seal the turnover.
Oh, I see. You are herding them into a trap.
Precisely.
This brings up a really interesting geographic feature of the rink the trapezoid. Because in the NHL, there is a painted trapezoid behind the goal, and the goalie is only permitted to play the puck inside those lines.
Right, which is a massive advantage for a forechecking center.
How so?
Well, if you are executing a dump and chase where you intentionally shoot the puck deep into the corner and race to retrieve it, you aim for the corners, deliberately avoiding the trapezoid.
Oh, because the goalie is legally restricted from playing the puck in the corner, so the opposing defensemen are forced to go retrieve it with their backs turned.
Exactly, while you bear down on them at full speed.
But wait, what if I'm not playing in the NHL? What if I am playing in a local rink that doesn't have a trapezoid painted on the ice?
This is a critical rulebook variance. USA Hockey and Hockey Canada do not have a trapezoid rule. It just does not exist in their rulebooks.
Right, really?
Yeah. Their goalies are completely free to skate out of the crease, go right into the deep corners, and calmly stop your dump-in, acting as a third defenseman.
So a goalie in amateur hockey could just kill the dump-and-chase strategy entirely. If the goalie can play the puck in the corners, is the dump-and-chase just a waste of time under USA Hockey rules?
It is severely nerfed, but it isn't useless, provided you understand the limits of the goalie's freedom.
Okay, explain that. What are the limits?
While an amateur goalie can play the puck in the corner, they cannot freeze it there to force a stoppage of play. Under USA Hockey rules, if a goalie's body is entirely outside the goal crease and they smother the puck to freeze it, they are assessed a minor penalty for delay of game.
Wow. Okay. And what about Hockey Canada?
Hockey Canada is even more blunt. If the goalie leaves the crease to freeze the puck, it is an automatic minor penalty. No warnings.
Okay, so the strategy just shifts then. You still pressure hard into the corner because you know the goalie is forced to keep the puck moving. You are pressuring them to make a rushed, panicked pass.
Exactly.
Okay, now let's move from the corners to the absolute danger zone, the goal crease. Because setting a screen in front of the goalie is a huge part of a center's job on offense. Where exactly should I position myself?
This requires absolute precision. To set an effective screen, you need to stand roughly 6 to 8 feet out from the goal line, positioned between the faceoff dots, and you must be entirely off the red line that borders the goal crease. You cannot let a single toe touch the blue paint.
Okay, let's dive deep into Rule 69 here, which governs interference on the goaltender. Because the variations across different rule books are honestly just staggering.
They really are. Let's start with the NHL and IIHF standard. If you set a clean screen outside the blue paint and your teammate shoots and scores, the goal is perfectly legal.
Right, obviously.
But the moment you step inside the crease, everything changes. Under NHL rules, if you enter the blue paint and your physical presence impairs the goaltender's ability to move freely or defend the net, the goal is disallowed.
Wait, even if I don't physically bump into the goalie, just standing in their space voids the goal.
Yes, your presence obstructing their movement within their own protected area is enough to void the goal.
Okay, but what if I am standing legally outside the paint and a massive 220-pound defenseman shoves me from behind right into the crease, like a split second before the puck goes in?
Under NHL and IIHF rules, if you are forcefully shoved into the crease by a defender, it does not automatically void the goal, but it comes with a massive caveat.
Which is?
You must demonstrate a reasonable effort to vacate the crease. You cannot use the shove as an excuse to set up camp in the blue paint. If you actively try to get out of the goalie's way and the puck goes in, the goal will likely stand.
Okay, that seems fair. How does that compare to USA Hockey?
USA Hockey applies a much flatter, stricter standard. If you intentionally position yourself with a skate in the crease and your teammate scores, the goal is disallowed. The referee doesn't even have to judge whether you impaired the goalie. Your positional violation is enough.
Oh, wow, that's strict. What if I get shoved in under USA Hockey rules?
Now, if a defender shoves you into the crease, USA Hockey will excuse your position and allow the goal, but only if the goaltender is completely out of the play.
And if they aren't out of the play?
If the goaltender is scrambling to make a save and your body is in the way, even though you were pushed there against your will, the goal is disallowed, and you will receive an interference minor penalty.
That is incredibly strict. You get penalized for being assaulted by a defenseman. But you mentioned earlier that Hockey Canada is the strictest governing body on the planet when it comes to the crease.
It is terrifyingly strict, and every player needs to understand this before playing in Canada. Under Hockey Canada rules, if a defender cross-checks you from behind into their own goaltender, and you fail to make an immediate visible effort to avoid that contact, you don't just lose the goal.
Let me guess, a penalty.
Yes. You are assessed a minor penalty for interference. The referee will penalize you for the contact caused by the defender.
That's crazy.
And it gets worse. Furthermore, if you arrive at the crease with speed and charge the goaltender, even accidentally, Hockey Canada mandates a major penalty plus an automatic game misconduct.
A major penalty.
Yes. And if the referee judges there was an intent to injure, it scales straight up to a match penalty.
Wait, I need to make sure I'm hearing this correctly. If I am playing aggressive, hard-nosed offensive hockey, driving the net for a rebound, and I crash into the goalie in Canada, it doesn't just cost my team a minor penalty. It literally ends my night. I am sent to the showers immediately.
Yes. Arriving forcefully into the goaltender in Canada is a mandatory ejection.
What?
The NHL and USA Hockey give referees the discretion to assess a minor penalty for a typical collision. Hockey Canada removed that discretion for forceful contact. You will be ejected. Keep your toes out of the blue paint.
That is a staggering detail that completely changes how you have to play the position geographically. Okay, so synthesizing the offensive zone for the listener.
Right.
We rely on the math of the slot. We use the sanctuary behind the net to exploit the Royal Road. We steer the defense on the forecheck to force rushed plays away from the trapezoid. And we treat the blue paint of the crease like a literal laser security grid, depending on which country's rulebook we are playing under.
Which brings us naturally to the events that happen when the goalie inevitably covers that puck and stops the play.
Right. We move into the game, within the game faceoffs and special teams. We are transitioning from the fluid spatial flow of the ice into the static set pieces that truly define the unique responsibilities of the center.
Yes. And I want to start by addressing a huge misconception here.
I think I know where you're going with this, because I want to challenge a massive assumption right out of the gate. The narrative around centers is that they must dominate the faceoff dot. Like, if you are losing draws, you are fundamentally failing your team and losing the possession battle.
That is what I call the myth of the faceoff. The actual mathematical data tells a completely different story.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In an average NHL game, there are roughly 56 faceoffs. When statisticians analyzed 11 full seasons of data to see how much faceoff wins actually matter, they found that a team's faceoff win percentage explained only about 6% of the variation in their overall points percentage in the standings.
Okay, I have to push back on this 6% stat. You are telling me the faceoffs barely matter.
That's what the data suggests for the vast majority of them.
But if you watch a playoff game, a clean face-off win in the offensive zone directly results in a one-timer goal. It changes the entire momentum of a series. How can you say that doesn't matter?
You are confusing all draws with leverage draws. A clean win in the offensive zone leading to a goal is a massive event, yes. But those draws represent a tiny fraction of the 56 face-offs in a game.
Okay, that's fair.
The vast majority of face-offs occur in the neutral zone, in the middle of the second period. Those draws are essentially 50-50 coin flips. Even if you win a neutral zone draw, the puck is often immediately chipped deep or turned over within 5 seconds. The possession game is fleeting and basically inconsequential.
So out of those 56 draws, how many actually dictate the outcome of the game?
Roughly 10 to 15.
Only 10 to 15?
Yeah. The draws that matter immensely are defensive zone faceoffs, draws on special teams like power plays and penalty kills, draws in the final minute of a close game, and draws immediately following an icing violation.
Okay, those are the high leverage moments where you must focus your mental energy and physical execution. The rest is statistical noise. So let's talk about the physical mechanics of mastering the dot itself and the legal traps surrounding it. Because I've always wondered about the setup. When both centers approach the dot, who is legally obligated to put the blade of their stick down on the ice first? Is it just a staring contest?
Oh, not at all. It is entirely dictated by the rules, and once again, those rules shift wildly depending on where you were playing.
Go figure.
Right. In the NHL and International IIHF play, at 8 of the 9 face-off dots on the ice, the defending center is required to place their stick on the ice first.
Which gives the attacking center a massive reactionary advantage. They get to see exactly how the defender is gripping the stick and angle their own blade accordingly.
Precisely. The rules are designed to favor the offense. But what happens if you play under USA Hockey?
Let me guess, they flip it.
They completely reverse it. Yeah. Under USA Hockey rules, the attacking player must place their stick down first at all 9 dots. The defensive center gains the reactionary advantage.
Wow, that fundamentally changes the strategy of the draw. And what about Hockey Canada?
Hockey Canada takes a third, completely different route. The visiting center must push their stick down first at every single spot on the ice, regardless of whether they are attacking or defending.
So the home team gets the advantage on every single draw.
Every single one.
That's crazy. And if I happen to be playing in a domestic league in Britain?
In Britain, they recently amended the IIHF rule for domestic play. Either center can put their stick down first. There is no required order.
Oh, so at a staring contest there.
Pretty much. However, they strictly enforce a geographic rule. Your entire stick blade, not just the toe or the heel, but the entire blade must be touching the white painted portion of the face-off circle.
Okay, here is a scenario that confuses fans constantly. You are the center. You get into your stance, your stick placement is perfectly legal, you haven't twitched, and suddenly the linesman blows the whistle, points at you, and ejects you from the face-off circle. What just happened?
You fell victim to the winger trap.
The winger trap?
Yes. As a center, you are responsible for the legal alignment of your entire line during a draw. If your winger, who is lined up on the hash marks outside the circle, leans over the line or creeps into the circle before the puck drops, the linesman will eject you, the center, from the draw.
Wait, it doesn't matter that it was the winger's mistake. The center pays the penalty.
Exactly. And this is now strictly enforced across all four major rule books. You have to actively manage your wingers before the drop.
So you literally have to tell them to stay back.
You have to tell them, do not move or you will get me tossed. And under USA Hockey and Hockey Canada rules, it is even stricter. If your winger's stick simply crosses the vertical plane of the hash marks in the air, you get tossed.
That is brutal.
Yeah.
Now, I know there is one specific game situation where you get a free pass for a face-off violation.
Yes, the icing exemption.
Right. Explain how that works.
When a team ices the puck, shooting it down the length of the ice from behind the center red line, the rules prohibit them from making a line change. They are trapped on the ice, completely exhausted. Because the stakes of this defensive zone draw are so incredibly high, the NHL, IIHF, and Hockey Canada in their higher junior divisions offer a grace period.
A grace period.
Yes. On a post-icing draw, the first face-off violation by either team results in a warning, not an ejection. You get one free chance to aggressively cheat the timing of the drop.
Oh, that's huge. But what if you violate the timing twice on the same draw?
Then your team is assessed a 2-minute bench minor for delay of game. But that first warning is a free pass to push the limits.
Now, notice you didn't mention USA Hockey in that exemption.
Because USA Hockey offers no grace period whatsoever.
Of course they don't.
Yeah. Under USA Hockey rules, a post-icing draw is treated exactly like any other draw in the first minute of the game. If you violate the rules, you are ejected instantly, regardless of how tired your line is.
Man, USA Hockey is strict. Okay, let's talk about handling the actual puck, because pucks pop up in the air off the face-off all the time, or just during the course of play. Can I just catch it out of the air with my glove?
Yes, catching the puck out of the air is perfectly legal across all rule books, provided you immediately knock it down to the ice. It must be a fluid, nearly continuous motion of catching and dropping.
What happens if I hold on to it for a second too long?
Closing your hand over the puck to conceal it, or smothering it against your body, or the ice to force a stoppage, is an automatic minor penalty.
Wow, okay.
And the location of the infraction dictates the severity. If you panic and smother the puck while standing inside your own goal crease, the referee will award the opposing team a penalty shot.
A penalty shot just for grabbing the puck?
Yes. And if you smother the puck in your crease while your goaltender has been pulled for an extra attacker and the net is empty, the referee will simply award an automatic goal to the other team.
Wow. Okay. And is there a specific hand pass rule that applies only to centers during a face-off?
Yes, there is. During a live face-off, centers are the absolute only players on the ice explicitly forbidden from playing the puck with their hand to win the draw.
Really? Just the centers?
Just the centers. If the puck pops straight up in the air off the linesman's hand, you cannot bat it out of the air with your glove. You must use your stick or your torso.
But a winger could bat it.
A winger can bat it, a defenseman can bat it, but if the center uses their hand before a third player touches the puck, it is an immediate penalty.
Okay, that's a great detail to remember. So, rounding out this section with special teams, when the referee's arm goes up and we get a power play, where does the center establish their office?
Most modern professional and high-level amateur power plays run a 1-3-1 formation. As the center, you are deployed in the bumper position.
The bumper?
Yes. This means you are stationed right in the middle of the high slot, directly between the four penalty killers who are forming a defensive box.
But why put a player right in the middle of four defenders? Doesn't that just invite cross-checks and block passing lanes? Like, explain how standing there actually breaks the penalty killer's structure.
It creates a structural nightmare for the defense. The penalty killers want to keep their eyes on the puck on the perimeter. But if you are in the bumper, they constantly have to check over their shoulders to see where you are. You occupy the blind spots.
Ah, okay.
And your job isn't to hold the puck. Your job is to be a rapid-fire relay station.
What does that look like in practice?
The puck comes from the half wall to you, and within half a second, you either snap a quick shot on net or one touch, pass it down to the goal line. The penalty killers physically cannot rotate their heads and bodies fast enough to track a puck that moves through the center of their box that quickly.
That is brilliant. And what if the situation is reversed? Like, we take a penalty and we are on the penalty kill.
If the opponent is running that 1-3-1 power play, your team will likely counter with a diamond formation. As the center, you play the apex of the diamond.
The apex, yeah. Meaning the top point.
Exactly. You are the single player at the very top of the formation, closest to the blue line. Your sole objective is to aggressively pressure the opponent's point man, the quarterback of their power play, and physically block the shooting lane down the exact middle of the ice.
Awesome. So to synthesize faceoffs and special teams for everyone, we don't stress over the 56 total draws, right? We focus our execution on the 10 to 15 high-leverage draws that actually dictate momentum.
Right.
We memorize our local stick placement rules to gain the reactionary advantage, and we actively manage our wingers so they don't get us tossed.
Crucial step.
And on special teams, the center owns the high-leverage real estate in the middle, whether that means acting as a rapid relay bumper on the power play or the apex shot blocker on the penalty kill.
Perfect summary. Which brings us to the final phase of building this mental model. We need to talk about risk management and the back check.
Yes, defending in transition.
Exactly. This is where we discuss defending in transition and managing the macro game of fatigue and line changes.
Okay, let's paint the picture. We are in the offensive zone. We try a risky pass, and it gets picked off. The other team is flying back toward our zone on a counterattack. What is my exact spatial assignment as the center in the back check?
Your absolute priority as the center is to identify and neutralize the middle lane driver.
But my immediate instinct, and honestly, I think the instinct of 90% of players who turn the puck over, is to furiously chase down the guy carrying the puck to try and steal it back.
It is the most common instinct, and it is the most lethal defensive mistake you can make. The puck carrier is not your primary responsibility. They are the defense's job.
Really?
Yes. Your defensemen are already retreating, facing the play, and they have the proper geometric angle to gap up and force the puck carrier wide. If you, as the trailing center, swing wide to chase the puck carrier, you double cover the perimeter and completely abandon the middle of the ice.
And who is filling that middle space?
The late arriving forward. The second or third wave of the attack. An opponent charging full speed, completely unmarked, right down the center lane into the high slot, is statistically the most dangerous player on the ice. They are stepping right into that 10 to 15% conversion zone.
Oh, man. Yeah, that's a guaranteed goal if they get a pass.
Exactly. So you must ignore the puck carrier, take the middle lane, match the speed of that late trailer, and lift their stick to neutralize them.
Okay, I understand the spatial assignment. Take the middle. Now let's talk about the physical mechanics of checking on the back check. If I am skating back as hard as I can, and the opponent I am tracking is skating away from me toward my net, they have their back to me. How do I legally engage them?
This requires a severe safety warning, because the rule books have evolved drastically to eliminate dangerous hits in this exact scenario.
So no hitting from behind.
Right. Do not plan your back check around delivering a hit, especially not from behind. In the NHL and IIHF, there is no such thing as a 2-minute minor penalty for checking from behind. The penalty simply does not exist.
Wait, there is no minor option at all. It just escalates immediately.
Yes. In professional and international play, a check from behind starts at a mandatory 5-minute major penalty and an automatic game misconduct. You are ejected from the game immediately.
Wow. What about USA Hockey and Hockey Canada?
They do retain a minor penalty option in their rule books, but it always carries an additional 10-minute misconduct with it, effectively removing you from a quarter of the game.
That's huge.
And it easily escalates to major and match penalties if the hit is forceful. Furthermore, USA Hockey has banned body checking entirely at the 12 and under youth levels,
right,
in all girls and women's hockey, and in non-Czech adult leagues.
Really?
Yes, and their casebook mandates a major or match penalty for any forceful hit from behind that drives a player into the boards.
So what is the tactical approach if I can't hit them?
Your job on the back check is not to blow the opponent up. Your job is to steer. You take a superior skating angle, establish body positioning to take away their access to the pass, and focus your physical engagement entirely on lifting or pinning their stick. You play the puck, you do not hit the numbers on their back.
That's a great distinction. Play the puck, not the numbers. Okay, let's shift to the macro game. Let's talk about icing mechanics. We are trapped in our defensive zone, the opponent's cycle has exhausted us, and I just need to get the puck down the ice to relieve the pressure.
Right, a desperation clear.
Exactly. But I don't want the referee to call an icing, which would force us to stay on the ice for another defensive zone draw. How do I avoid a lazy icing call on a dump-in?
You need to utilize the red line secret. The rule that governs icing judges the geographic location of the puck, not the location of your physical skates.
Ooh. Explain how I can manipulate that geometry.
If you are skating the puck up the ice toward the center red line, and the puck, which is on the blade of your stick in front of you, makes physical contact with the red paint of that line, your dump-in is completely legal.
Wait, really?
Yes. It does not matter if your body or your skates haven't crossed the line yet. The root of your stick and the puck touching the paint is all that matters.
So I don't need to skate my entire body over the line before shooting it deep. I just need to carry it that extra half stride to ensure the rubber touches the red paint.
Exactly.
Because if I miss it by an inch, the punishment is brutal.
The punishment is a tactical disaster. In the NHL and IIHF, if you ice the puck, your line is prohibited from changing. You are forced to stay out there, gasping for air on dead legs, to take a high-leverage defensive zone face-off against a fresh opposing line.
That's the worst feeling in hockey.
It is. Now, there is a variance here. Hockey Canada only restricts line changes on icing in specific high-level leagues, like U18 AAA and Junior A.
And USA Hockey.
USA Hockey, incredibly, actually allows the offending team to change lines after an icing at all levels.
Sweet.
Yeah. But in a league that prohibits the change, a missed red line is a catastrophic error.
Speaking of dead legs, what is the ultimate rule of thumb for managing fatigue and line changes as a center?
The rule is simple. You fade first, and you lead the change. We established at the very beginning that territory matters more than mileage, right?
Right.
Because you are covering the full length and width of the ice, supporting the defense low, and leading the rush high, you are performing significantly more high-intensity sprints than your wingers. You will burn out faster.
So how long should a proper shift be?
A well-managed, high-intensity shift for a center is 30 to 45 seconds. The moment you feel your legs losing that explosive first step, you must get off the ice.
Just call it and go.
You call the change, you skate to the bench, and your wingers must read your exit and follow you. If you try to extend your shift to a minute, you become a defensive liability.
This has been an incredibly dense, rewarding journey across the ice. I mean, we have taken the raw physics of the game and layered the traffic laws on top of it.
We covered a lot of ground today.
We really did.
Yeah.
So it is time for our final mastery review. Mm-hmm. I want you to synthesize this entire discussion, pull all of these concepts together to solidify that coherent mental framework we promised the listener at the beginning of the hour.
The overarching lesson here is that a center is not merely a skater with a good wrist shot. A center is a spatial processor. You are an on-ice architect, and you are a rulebook navigator.
I love that. Rulebook navigator.
The highest IQ players realize that hockey is a game of shifting geometry, and they leverage the specific rules of their governing league to exploit that geometry. So if you only remember 10 things from this masterclass to take with you to the rink, remember these.
Okay, let's hear them. Number one.
Number one. You are the link. Read the play constantly. Do not just stand in a static spot because your roster position says center. Positional fluidity wins.
Number two.
Number two. In the defensive zone, always swing below the hash marks to give your defense a safe outlet on the breakout.
Number three.
Number three. Defensive zone under pressure. Never, ever try a skill play in the middle lane. Rim it or reverse it to survive.
Number four.
Number four is neutral zone geometry. Keep your head up and utilize the middle third. That is where you have 360-degree vision and where you distribute to speed.
Number five.
Number five, the forecheck. Steer the defender into a trap. Don't just hunt for a massive hit. And remember, F1 goes to whoever arrives first, not whoever wears the C.
Number six.
Number six is the offensive zone. Shoot from the slot because the math dictates a 15% conversion rate. And keep your skates entirely out of the blue paint.
Number seven.
Number seven, face-offs. Do not let a lost draw ruin your confidence. Focus your intensity only on the 10 to 15 leverage draws that define the game and master your local stick down order.
Number eight.
Number eight is the back check. Ignore the puck carrier. Identify and lock down the late middle lane driver to prevent the high danger slot shot.
Number nine.
Rulebook traps. Never smother a puck in your crease unless you want to hand the opponent a free penalty shot and know exactly how your offside tag up works.
And finally, number 10.
Number 10. Managing fatigue. Keep your shifts explosive between 30 to 45 seconds. Recognize that you will fade before the wingers do and take the initiative to lead the line change.
Brilliant. We spend so much of our time focusing on the physical tools.
Yeah.
You know, we practice our edge work. We dial in the perfect flex on our deposit sticks. We shoot hundreds of pucks at a tarp in the driveway.
Oh, yeah. Constantly.
Right. But hockey is fundamentally played on ice, a frictionless surface designed to maximize speed. But a true center plays the game on time and space. Think about this. If every player on the ice perfectly executed their system, perfectly adhered to the geometry, and never made a single mistake, a hockey game would end in a 0-0 tie.
It absolutely would.
It is the breakdown of those systems, the microseconds of human hesitation, that creates offense. Your job isn't just to play a perfect system. Your job is to process the geometry faster than the opponent, forcing their system to break first.
Exactly.
So the next time you watch a game, don't watch the puck. Watch the spaces where the puck isn't, because that is where the center is already winning the game.
Seeing the blueprint behind the chaos, that is true mastery of the position.
Exactly. The chaos is just a system waiting to be understood. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Take these mental models, apply this blueprint, and go own the middle of the ice.